So there are some phrases in life that get used in conversations that sometimes cause us to bristle. One of the comments that gets made is daylight savings time. Sometimes causes us to bristle. But there are others that cause us to bristle in a different way. When someone comes and tells us, you should, or you ought to, or you need to, or you have to, or you must, when we're met with the sense that starts with any of those phrases, there's almost a part of us that starts to tense up right away. Because we don't like being told what to do. We tend to not like being told. Now, there's an exception to not like being told what to do, and that is when we're told what to do will benefit us in some way. If we think that what we're being told to do will benefit us, we're more likely to receive it well. But when we perceive that what we're being told to do will keep us from doing what we want to do, we tend to resist. We tend to bristle. The reality is, most of us just don't like to be told what to do. We tend to push back against rules and parameters and those types of things because we want to be in charge, we want to be in control, and we want to be able to do what we want to do when we want to do it. Right? Right. The reality is that everywhere we go, there are rules that are set in place. And the rules that are set in place are usually set in place by the rule maker. Now, we like to be the rule maker. We don't mind telling everyone else what to do. We just don't like when the rule maker tells us what to do. For example, when we go to an amusement park and we get on the roller coaster, there is almost always a sign somewhere that says, please keep your hands and feet inside the ride at all times. There's a reason why that rule is put in place by the rule maker. When we leave today and you turn left out of the parking lot or right out of the parking lot, somewhere along this stretch of road, you're going to encounter a sign with a number on it and two words. The number will coincide with the number on the speedometer on your car. The words say speed limit, which means the number on the sign that coincides with the number of the car is the limit of speed that you are to travel on this road. Now, we've all driven this stretch of road. How many of us have ever exceeded the speed limit on this road? How many of us have ever felt guilty for exceeding the speed limit on this road? The reality is, and here's the interesting thing, all of us raised our hands that we had exceeded the speed limit, which means you are guilty. Very few of us raised our hands that said we felt guilty. Because the rule is there, whether we choose. Now, if you've traveled this road, how many of you that have exceeded the speed limit have in your mind already come up with the excuse that you're going to use when you cross right out here and the sheriff or the state trooper that sits in this parking lot all the time gets you this time? How many of you come up with the excuse? You know what you're going to say. And you're going to look at the officer and you're going to say, I know you've heard this 1,000 times and I know most people are lying to you, but this is really, really true. I got to go to the bathroom. So write me that ticket fast. You see, rules exist. We know rules exist. But we tend to resist them because even when it comes to what we believe, what we choose to believe will have a rule system around it. All of the major religions have some type of a belief system or a rule system in place around what you believe. There's the five pillar of There's the five pillars of Islam. There's the Ten Commandments. There's the Sermon on the Mount. In every belief system. So you would think that when we choose to embrace a belief system around how we will approach life, that when we approach life, we will choose to obey the rules that are in place in the belief system we choose to navigate life with, right? How many of you have ever noticed that there are people somewhere in the world, there are people in the world who profess that they embrace a belief system while not staying within the context of the parameters and the rules of that belief system? Anybody ever notice that? Why? The reason is because we don't like to be told what to do. Now, how many of us here today have heard of the Ten Commandments? All right, so since we've all heard of the Ten, how many of you feel pretty confident that you got a good handle on the Ten Commandments, either in the way you approach life or what they are? Okay, for those of you that have a good approach on the Ten Commandments, turn to your neighbor and tell them all 10 of the commandments. The Ten Commandments, though they're probably the most famous and the most well-known set of rules in the history of the world, we can't say them. We try to live by them, but we can't say them. But those rules exist for a reason. And the reason is to suck all of the joy and fun out of life. I mean, that's what rules exist for. That's not why rules are in place. These rules exist within the context of a story about a relationship between God and humankind to provide the best for humankind so that they can experience the best of relationship with God. That's why the Ten Commandments exist. That's why the rules exist. That's why God has established parameters within life, because He is concerned about the relationship and He is concerned about the type of life that we live. The context of the Ten Commandments comes in the story of the nation of Israel, who had been enslaved by Egypt for 430 years. After 430 years, Moses leads the people out of Egypt and begins them on a journey to the land that they called the Promised Land. It was a land God promised to give them to call home. And so they're leaving Egypt. And the leader of Egypt, Pharaoh, who had let the nation of Israel leave, all of a sudden changes his mind. It's kind of like this buyer's remorse thing. I let him go. Well, why did I let him go? I shouldn't have done that. Now I got to change my mind. So he establishes all of his army, and he sends his army out to chase the Israelites, catch them, and bring them back to Egypt. So the nation of Israel is leaving, has left Egypt and is on their way on this journey. Now the Egyptian army is chasing them down. And all of a sudden, the nation, not all of a sudden, because like, you know, but in a moment, they arrive at the Red Sea. And now, standing between them and where they need to go is the Red Sea, while all the while behind them is the Egyptian army coming. And they're stuck. No way out. In relationship with a God who had delivered them from Egypt and promised to give them a land to call home and is getting ready to establish rules with which to live by, there's no way out. And I love the message that Moses delivers to the nation of Israel in this moment of their history. Now, as I read this, just kind of try to put yourself in the storyline, okay? Again, you're part of this big nation that's been rescued from slavery after 430 years. There's the Red Sea in front of you and the Egyptian army bearing down on behind you, okay? This is the context. This is the story. When Moses all of a sudden stands before them and says, "Do not be afraid. Stand firm. And you will see the deliverance the Lord will bring you today. The Egyptians you see today, you will never see again. The Lord will fight for you. You need only to be still." This is actually for several different reasons. One of the verses that I'm holding on to and leaning into for this year, just a lot of reasons. And there's two or three passages that talk about standing firm, and a passage that Paul wrote that says, "And when you've done all else to stand, stand firm." And so I'm really holding on to these passages this year for a variety of reasons. But put yourself in this situation again. Red Sea, Egyptian army, God's promise, all of that. And Moses says, you don't need to do anything. Just stand firm. God will fight for you. You need to only be still. Now, the phrase here in the original Hebrew language for "you need to only be still" doesn't mean inactivity. It doesn't mean inactivity. What it means is, in essence, trust and stop complaining. And Moses tells the people of Israel, yeah, things look like this and things look like this and this is the dynamic, but what you need to do right now is you need to just trust God and stop complaining. So this is the context that's going on. And so God tells Moses what's going to happen. God tells Moses how he is going to once again rescue Israel, not just from Egypt, but from the Egyptian army in the face of the Red Sea. And then this is what happens. It says, then Moses Friday night, he worked until 11 o'clock and had to be back in at 8 the next morning and was supposed to work until a certain time, and then they asked him if he could stay 5 extra hours. So he's a little tired this morning. And for those of you who don't know, that's my son, so I can say that about my son. I would never say that about Stephen or Randy or any of them. Yes, I would. So then, you're in this scene, okay? Then Moses stretched out his hand over the sea. And all that night, the Lord drove the sea back with a strong east wind and turned it into dry land. The waters were divided, and the Israelites went through the sea on dry ground with a wall of water on their right and on their left. God rescues the nation of Israel again. Now the rest of the story goes that all of them cross the ground on dry land. And here's a question. If you were in the story, if you were in that situation, if it looked like you had no way out, this in front of you, this in back of you, and there was no way out, and all of a sudden, the waters part, the path is clear, would you take the first step? Every person in the nation of Israel took the first step, and then the next step, and all of them passed. And so then after they all pass, and the Egyptian army starts to go through, God releases the water, and it comes in and destroys them. And guess what happens? All of the Egyptians that the Israelites saw that day, they would never see again, just like God promised. Would you take that first step? And so this is the context. This moment is about 2 months into the journey of, I'm sorry, not this moment with the sea and all that. Where we go next is about 2 months into the journey with the nation of Israel. The trip from Egypt to the Promised Land was 11 days. So they're already 2 months into it, and God sets the context for the rules that he is about to give. And we haven't even got to the rules yet, right? Which means, guess what? Which means that there is so much more to rules than the rules. There's a huge context. There's a huge story in this story and in our lives about why the rules are in place. And so God continues to set the context for the rules. And he says, and you will be my kingdom of priests, my holy nation. This is the message you must give to the people of Israel. So God tells Moses to tell the people, you will be my kingdom of priests, my holy nation. A kingdom is defined as a country, a state, a territory, something that is governed and ruled by a king or queen. By definition, when God tells Israel that they will be a kingdom, He's telling them they will have a king that will rule over them. And guess what a king gets to do? A king gets to establish rules. A king gets to set parameters. And so they will have a king. And God tells them that they will be His kingdom, which means He will be their king. And He will establish the rules, and He will establish the law. And they will be a kingdom of priests. The context of this for the nation of Israel would have been understood in this very new idea of a priest in their belief system. The very first priest, Levitical priest, was a guy by the name of Aaron, who was Moses' brother, who had helped him convince Pharaoh through God's plagues to release the people of Israel. And then God established this office of priest. And so the nation of Israel would have understood that when God was telling them they would be a kingdom of priests, they would have talked about, okay, what's God established with Aaron? Well, what He established with Aaron and his four sons who also served as priests were that they were to serve as intermediaries between the people and God. That they were to serve the people and serve as an intermediary between. So a kingdom of priests would be a kingdom under God's rule that would serve as an intermediary between the people, other nations, and God. So He is rescuing Israel so that they will be a kingdom under His rule of priests who will point the other nations to God. They will be a kingdom in which they will be blessed so that other nations will be blessed through them and be directed to God as a result of Israel's relationship with God. That's what this phrase, kingdom of priests, means. Holy, they will be a holy nation. The word holy means set apart. So in other words, the nation of Israel will be set apart from the other nations. They will have a unique relationship with God in such a way that the other nations will see their relationship with God, see the results of their relationship with God, and wonder why they can't have a relationship with God as well. And God will say, guess what? You can. That was His intent all along in His relationship with Israel, which was special and unique and all of that. It was so that other nations could come to know and understand and desire relationship with God as well. So in this moment, just a short time after rescuing them from Egypt and then rescuing them from the Egyptian army, God tells Moses to tell them, you will be my kingdom under my rule of priests to serve as an intermediary between the other nations and God, and you will be a holy nation. You will be set apart for this purpose. I don't know about you, but that's pretty cool. And so this is the context in which God then establishes the law, the rule. The Ten Commandments are not just Ten Commandments. They are actually in the context of dozens of laws, dozens of rules that are set in place for how to live life, how to approach relationship with God for the nation of Israel, and also the leaders of the nation of Israel eventually turn these dozens of laws into 613 commandments. So the Ten Commandments are in the context of this relationship thing with God. And this is when God then begins to tell them what this living as a holy nation, a kingdom of priests set apart for this purpose, would look like and how to live this out. And He goes and He tells them. Here's how He introduces the law. Oh, never mind. This isn't how He introduces the law. This is how the people respond. And the people responded together, we will do everything the Lord has commanded. In other words, we'll follow the rules. We'll do what we're supposed to do, and we'll not do what we're not supposed to do. And we'll honor the speed limit, We'll go 45 when we're supposed to go 45, and we'll go 55 when we're supposed to go 55. We'll clean up our rooms when our mom and dad tell us. We'll be nice to our sister. We'll be nice to our brother. Oh, I'm sorry. Did I get a little too personal there? The people responded, we'll do everything that the Lord has commanded. And then God gives them the law. So Moses brought the people's answer back to the Lord. Go to the next slide. Then God gave the people all these instructions. I am the Lord your God. Okay, that's not really an instruction. That's identifying who you are. And that's exactly the point. God starts the instructions by saying, I am the Lord your God. In other words, I am the king who's going to establish the rules. I am the Lord your God. Israel would have gotten really, really used to a polytheistic culture in Israel. Egypt had gods of nature, gods of this, gods of that, gods of that. And so each of the little g gods were over certain areas of life. And God makes it clear to the nation of Israel that I am the Lord your God. I am the only God, and there is no other. I am the Lord your God. He is establishing himself as the one with the authority and the credibility to establish the rules. And then he goes on to say, I am the Lord your God who rescued you from the land of Egypt, the place of your slavery. So God establishes his authority, and then he reminds the people what he had done for them. I rescued you out of Egypt, and then I rescued you from the Egyptian army. So I've proven myself to you, in other words, is what he's saying here. And when he addresses them and he says, I have rescued you out of your slavery. He has rescued them out of their slavery, which means they are now a free people. They are free to choose. They are no longer under the rule of the Egyptian Pharaoh. They are now free to choose how they will live. They can choose to embrace God. They can choose to reject God. They can choose to do their own thing. But they are now free to choose how they will respond to a God who has established his authority and who has gone to great lengths to prove and provide relationship with him for them, all of which he did not have to do. God was not obligated to rescue the nation of Israel out of Egypt. God was not obligated to part the Red Sea and allow the Israelites to walk through and then to destroy the Egyptian army. God was not obligated to do any of it. God chose to do all of it. And the reason God chose to do all of it is not so he could invoke the rule, but so he could embrace the relationship. Relationship precedes rules for God in relationship with the nation of Israel and in the relationship with people like you and people like me. And so then God says, in this context, he says, you must not have any other God but me. This is the first rule that God establishes. There was no other God. In all the Egyptian gods, there was no other God that established relationship with the people of Israel. There was no other God that rescued them. There was no other God that did this. There was no other God. And God says, I am the one God. Trust me. And I don't want to oversimplify this, but I have to wonder if God didn't give that rule first, because if we could get that one right, all the others would fall into place. If you think about it, of the Ten Commandments that you can remember, how many of them, when they get broken because we put something else in place of that rule? You know, the one of the rules is not to steal. But when we cheat on our taxes to get a bigger refund, didn't we just place the bigger refund over the rule? And if we put the bigger refund over the rule, didn't we just put the bigger refund over the rule maker? You must not have any other God before me. If you think about it, when we break all those rules, isn't it because we put something else in place over them and over the rule maker? And so those things become more important than relationship with God, where God is sitting back going, I'm putting these things in place because of how important the relationship with me is and the relationship between me and you is. Isn't it us who sometimes get it backwards? So God, I think maybe God puts this in place so that if we get this right, everything else, if the way that we navigate life is about not having any other gods but God, then all the other decisions kind of begin to fall in place in that context, right? That's the context that God gives all the rules. I am the Lord your God who rescued you out of Egypt. I've delivered you from this, I've delivered you, and I desire a relationship with you more than anything else. And so just don't have any other gods before me. And the nation of Israel, right before this, how did they respond when Moses came and said, you know, don't be afraid, just stand firm? They said, we'll do everything. Everything, just as the Lord commanded, they agreed. After God delivers the rules, they agree again. They say, "Yep, we're good. We're going to do everything just like God commanded." And so you would think, God's established His authority. God's established His credibility. God has gone to great lengths to prove the context of relationship with Him. He's delivered the rules. He's put the parameters in place. The people of Israel have said, yep, we're good. We're going to do everything the Lord commanded. And so now you think it's a no-brainer. This is like everything's set right to go to the promised land, right? This is 2 months into an 11-day journey. 2 months into an 11-day journey that then lasts another 40 years. They wander in the wilderness for 40 years. You know why they wander in the wilderness for 40 years? Because they can't get their hearts right around the first rule. When God gives Moses the Ten Commandments and sends him back to the people, God doesn't tell Moses, go and give the people the Ten Commandments. What the biblical narrative tells us is that God says, go, because the people have already screwed the first one up, and go get them back under control. Moses goes down there, and they've built a golden calf, or sitting there worshiping a golden calf. Moses gets mad and throws the rocks at them. Breaks the stone tablets that have the rules written on it, because they've already broke relationship. And again, I'm reading into the story here, but it's almost like if you can't get the first one right, what do all the others matter? And they all broke anyway. Goes to Aaron and says, Aaron, what were you doing? Man, I don't know. I told all the people to bring their golden jewelry to me, and I collected it all. I tossed it in the fire, and out came this calf. Such a magical moment. We thought we might as well worship the calf. After all, you'd been gone for 40 days. We didn't know what had happened to you. We thought maybe you died on the mountain. Well, God forbid anybody come look for me. Yeah, your solution instead of come and look for me is go to build a calf and worship a calf. To break the first rule, to destroy the context of the very rules that God put in place. For the next 40 years, they wander in the wilderness because they can't get their hearts right around the first rule that you shouldn't have any other God before me. They continue to do it over and over and over again. So, where do you think, in the midst of all of this, where do you think God went? The amazing thing is that God didn't go anywhere. God stayed right where He was. God continued to prove to a rebellious nation, He continued to go to great lengths to show them that he cared more about relationship than rules, that the rules were there in the context of relationship. God didn't go anywhere. He put the rules in place to protect the relationship, to protect the integrity of the way of life. He put the parameters in place, the guardrails in place, because you know where guardrails exist? Guardrails exist just before the danger. Guardrails exist to keep you from entering the danger zone. Guardrails exist before you make the decision. Guardrails don't exist to tell us what to do and what not to do. Guardrails exist to protect us and to keep us from harm and to keep us from danger. Guess when we get in trouble? When we go beyond the guardrail. Guess when our relationships get damaged? When we go beyond the guardrail. Guess when our relationship with God gets damaged? When we go beyond the guardrail. And the entire time, God is in the same place. With the same authority, the same credibility, gone to great lengths to demonstrate his love for us, even going so far as to send his very own son to die on the cross to redeem the sins that break relationship between us and God each and every time we step out of the guardrail. We don't like being told what to do. We push back. Anytime someone says, you should not, you must, you need to, you have to, you ought to, we don't like it. But everywhere we go, rules exist. And we push back against the rules, and we push back against the rule maker. In the context of what we believe, God is the rule maker. And the rules that he has put in place are there to protect our relationship with him, our relationships with one another, and our way of life. But yet far too often, the approach to life we take would say that we resist not only the rules, but we're rejecting the rule maker. And then we wonder why. Why we wind up somewhere we never intended to be. But where we ended up is the result of the decisions that we made along the way. You see, our perception is often that rules are put in place to suck the joy and fun out of life. That all the fun things, all the good things in life are outside the guardrails. And inside the guardrails is boring and unadventurous and all that stuff. But what about when we're able to flip our perception and say the life that God intends for us to live within the guardrails is actually the life that produces the most fun, the most joy, and the most adventurous life of all is found within the context of right relationship with God, doing the very things he wants us to do and not doing the very things he doesn't want us to do? What if that is the reason for the rules? What if the context of the rules is about relationship, and the context of the rules is that the grace of God precedes the law of God, which is exactly what we see in the story of the nation of Israel. God's grace was extended to them over and over and over before he even gave them the law. And then his grace was continued to be extended to them over and over and over, even after he gave them the law. I don't know about you, but that's my story. God's grace was extended to me long before, and God's grace has continued to extend to me long after. And so the joy and the fun and the adventure of life is found within the context of the rules, in relationship with God. Let me pray for you as we wrap things up today. Dear God, thank you for today. Thank you for this story in which we find that even though so many of us resist rules, resist the rule maker, that your grace has been extended to us before the law and after the law and around the law and in the law, and every aspect of the rules are there as a demonstration of your grace. Thank you for the lengths that you have gone to demonstrate that love to us. Even going so far as to send Jesus to redeem our sin. And God, today as we look at this story from the history of Israel many, many years ago, in some way help it to help each and every one of us to land at what Jesus did for us that we could never do for ourselves. And maybe for those who have never placed their trust in him before would consider doing so today because of your great grace and your great love, and then choose to live life within the guardrails that you establish. We pray all this in Jesus' name. Amen.